A superb lyrebird, as you will hear him in his forest home.
Dreadful, dreadful lives, those lyrebirds, aren't they? Welcome to Late Night Live, and tonight we're very much on an avian trip. It's a commonplace to talk about how birds descended from dinosaurs, but what is less well known and what will be revealed in some detail tonight is how important Australia has been to the development, the evolution of the bird. Birds got a flying start, were egged on here in Australia, and Tim Lowe has written a wonderful book about birds, and particularly the Australian contribution thereof, will be joining me. Some years ago, there was a very famous exploitation director, a man called Roger Corman, who made low-budget horror films, often starring, people who went on to become quite famous in the horror genre. There's a Matthias Cormann, our finance minister, was involved in the production of a low-budget budget. That stars, as I recall, Joe Hockey. I wonder if the two Cormans are related. Either way, the finance minister, Cormann, has been on the offensive, trying to sell the unsellable budget, and said that Australia needed a fiscal reality check, otherwise we'd end up like Europe. A bit of an echo of Paul Keating warning about banana republics. Now, back in June, LNL did a story on the state of European finances, and our guest was none other than Yiannis Varoufakis, and we welcome Yiannis back. He is, of course, Professor of Economic Theory from the University of Athens and visiting professor at the University of Texas, Austin. But on this occasion, he joins us from Athens via Skype. And Yiannis has just published in RN's White Paper, a special essay on Australia's austerity budget. Yiannis, thanks for your time.
It's great to be back.
Yiannis, austerity, it's tossed around a lot lately. What does it mean to an economist?
Well, let's begin with a definition. What do we mean by austerity? Any attempt to cut government spending below its normal, its long-term average, so as to pay down the nation's debt, supposedly, can be thought of as an austerity drive. Now, of course, it's nothing more than belt tightening, right? Now, at the level of the family or the individual, during difficult times, it's the obvious thing to do. It resonates with prudence. But the point I'm making is that at the level of a national economy, in difficult circumstances, it is tantamount to fiscal irresponsibility.
And I wonder whether there are times, however, Yiannis, when both Keynesian and market economists would agree that that we have to suffer for the greater good.
Well, you don't need to suffer. I mean, paying down debt is a wonderful aspiration during the booming times. When Australia, however, was booming with the resources boom, it wasn't doing that. Before that, during the long Howard years of very significant growth rates of the economy, instead of austerity, instead of paying down debt, you had the infamous tax cuts. So it seems to be absurd that instead of saving and paying down national debt during the good times, various governments around the world, including Australia's today, is trying to do the opposite.
Well, I remember you making the point on previous programs, in effect, that belt tightening can become a noose for a nation.
Indeed. Look, Philip, your income and my income has the privilege, however small it may be, of being independent of our spending. So if we skip, let's say, a holiday, we reduce our spending and our bottom line improves, especially during good bad times, is a good thing. But the tragedy of national income is that when our collective spending comes down, private and public spending, what is collective spending? Well, it's national income. So we don't have this privilege of the independence between our national income and our government expenditure that you and I have at our personal lives. This is the reason why we have this noose around our neck. And when the government goes austerian, this noose tightens up.
Now, our current government, as you well know, Jana, said it has to be tough now and cut government spending because of the debt mountain left by the Labour Party. Does that have any factual basis?
None whatsoever. Firstly, Australian national debt is at the low end of its historical spectrum. But even let's say that we agreed with Mr. Abbott and Mr. Hockey that it needs to be run down. It needs to be paid down. You don't do this during a period like the current one by austerian government spending cuts. Look, we've seen it all before. Think of what happened when Cameron and Osborne attempted exactly that using exactly the same arguments in 2010. You remember the argument was that unless Britain reduces its government spending, then the national debt is going to become a ball and chain around the nation's leg and interest rates are going to shoot through the roof. And the national debt is going to become unserviceable and Britain will become Greece, if you remember. And we all know what happened then.
Yanis, you've argued that the Joe Hockey austerity budget might conceivably be effective if it met two conditions. One, there has to be rapid growth in other countries.
Yes, indeed. Think of Canada in the 1990s, the government then, in around 1996, attempted to reduce the deficit and pay down debt. And it managed to do this through government spending cuts for a very simple reason. It was sitting next to the United States of America, which was booming remarkably. Of course, there were bubbles happening within Wall Street that were occasioning that boom. But nevertheless, Canada was riding on the back of exports to the United States. So when your trading partners are growing very fast, it is possible through government spending cuts to replace some of the government debt with private spending, and therefore everything is working out beautifully. But this is not the current set of circumstances for Australia.
Now, Yanis, I didn't mean to interrupt, but your second condition you cite as a condition for austerity to work is quite scary because it actually needs financial bubbles. And one recalls it was the popping of bubbles that was a principal reason for the GFC.
Indeed, another way that austerity can work is if the government is cutting, but then there are bubbles happening either in the stock exchange or primarily, in the case of Australia, in the housing market. Now, do we want this kind of austerity that works by inflating house prices, seemingly for a year or two or three, the government is making good earnings from this bubble, and it manages to pay down some of its deficit and debt. And the result of that is, the housing market popping, the housing market bubble popping, like it did in 1991, if you recall. And then what you end up with is a blowout of private debt, negative equity of householders, and at the same time, a blowout in public debt. That doesn't sound like prudence to me.
So what you're saying is that what failed in Britain and in the Eurozone is now being rather recklessly applied in Australia.
The pattern is exactly the same. In the United Kingdom in 2010, in the Eurozone, there are austerian voices in the Congress of the United States and now in Australia. So the very interesting question is, if I'm right that austerity fails by its own criteria and in the end debt goes up rather than down when governments cut spending savagely, why is austerity so popular amongst primarily conservative governments? That is an interesting question, isn't it?
Answer that question. Why?
Well, I think that austerity is just a good Protestant pretext for pursuing another wholesome end, nothing to do with debt, an end that politicians do not want to disclose. And that is a savage redistribution from the weaker, the less powerful members of society to the richer, more powerful members of society. And I think that the Australian government is proving the point as we speak.
Well, they may be trying to prove it, but they're not selling it. The public seems to agree with you rather than them, Yanis.
Well, this is a godsend, and I hope that logic prevails, because it's quite clear that if the government truly wanted to tackle the deficit, it had many avenues available that it chose not to take. It could cancel the diesel rebate, which distorts factor prices. It could reverse the Howard-era tax cuts, which no longer pay for themselves, as we've seen. They could bring back the carbon tax, couldn't they? And, of course, they could do something about the private health insurance subsidy. They are doing none of those things. And the reason is that austerity, deep down, is a thinly designed campaign to redistribute entitlements in favor of the powerful and the mighty at the expense of fiscal responsibility. That's my point. Of course, using the language of fiscal prudence.
Why is austerity economics so popular with economists and central bank governors? Surely they can't be blind to the sort of arguments you're mounting.
It's not true that it is popular with central bank governors. If you look at the Fed, for instance, Mr. Bernanke and now Ms. Yellen are quite clear that fiscal austerity is making their task of keeping the American economy afloat much, much harder. Similarly, if you were to talk to the governor of the Bank of England, you would not get, especially if it was behind closed doors, your conversation, you wouldn't get any ringing endorsement of austerity. Why do economists as a profession tend to side with austerity? Well, as a profession, we have sold our souls to the devil a long time ago, Philip, but this is another problem, I think.
There are, of course, many many very famous and admirable economists who have solidarity, but it does astonish me the way, presumably bubbling away in conservative think tanks, principally in the US, this whole sort of neocon idea has become so universal. Look, have austerity measures gone any distance to working anywhere? What happened in Greece, for example?
Well, Greece is a great example, isn't it? In the Eurozone in general, the harsher the austerity cuts imposed, the larger the public debt ended up being. So think Greece. 2010, we went bankrupt, right? The Greek state could not repay its debt. What was the Greek debt then? It was around 1.3 times national income, 130% of GDP, right? And then we had the most savage, the most outrageous austerity cuts in the history of civilization. Do you want to know what our debt is now? It's climbed up from 130% to 185%. So there you are. If you want a very vivid example of what happens when you try to cut debt by cutting expenditure in difficult circumstances, Greece is an excellent example. But not just Greece. Look at Italy. Look at Spain. Look at Britain itself. Britain was recovering between 2009 and 10. And then when in 2010 they imposed upon themselves austerity, the result was that they aborted the recovery for 3 long years. And that means huge social costs in the streets, especially north of Watford.
Yanis, you say that central bankers don't necessarily endorse this approach. I'm afraid ours does. As you know, Glenn Stevens, the head of the Reserve Bank, has said yesterday, as I recall, that this budget wasn't tough enough.
Well, he's an outlier in the international of central bankers. If you go together with Mr. Draghi and Ms. Yellen and Mr. Carney, I think he would be looked upon as a sad minority.
Yeah, okay. What's happening in the US now, Yanis? Is it in fact bouncing back at long last?
The United States has stabilized. This is the best we can say about the economy of the United States. It stabilized a few years ago. One reason, of course, was that it didn't have austerity. They had an initial stimulus, which was lukewarm, and this is why it didn't work particularly well and why the Obama administration did not reap any political benefits from it. But they didn't have any austerity, and instead, what they had was an ungovernable country, because Congress and the administration veto each other out of existence. And the only thing, that the only institution that was left holding the can, so to speak, was the Fed. And the Fed printed, as if there is no tomorrow, not so much money, but nevertheless loans for the banking system. And the banking system managed to maintain a semblance of stability. Now, the tragedy of the United States of America is that it no longer has the capacity to perform the role that it was performing before Lehman Brothers collapsed. It is just about managing to maintain a kind of equilibrium in the American macroeconomy, but it is looking upon the rest of the world, Europe, now Australia, and of course the goings on with Russia and so on, with great trepidation, because its stabilization is very precarious.
We've only got a couple of minutes left, but I'd like to revert to a discussion you and I had earlier in the year about the virtual currency Bitcoin. As I'm sure you know, our tax office has just announced a ruling that Bitcoin isn't a currency, but an asset used for capital gain. What is your view of that judgment, Jonas?
I think it's quite correct. I don't think that anyone is seriously using Bitcoin for transaction purposes, in order to purchase goods and services. And even if they do, the percentage of these of this usage is tiny. If people do buy Bitcoin, it's because it's a kind of a tulip, if you remember the Dutch tulip mania. People buy it simply because it's going up in price, and because they speculate that it will carry on going up in price. So it's a speculative asset, and I think that on this occasion, I shall agree wholeheartedly with the Australian authorities.
Okay, you've just been appointed the Federal Treasurer of Australia. What are you going to do to sort us out? What policies will you be implementing?
The number one priority for the Australian government should be investment. Given the diminution of the resources boom and the projection of highly reduced investment by the mining era, but by the mining lobby, the mining firms, what is of the utmost importance at the moment is to replace that investment with investment in productive capacity outside the mining sector. I think that Australia should take a leaf out of China, the way that China responded in 2008 to the prospect of diminished demand for its exports. Australia should be copying this and should be putting in place a developmental plan for replacing chronically underfunded infrastructure and looking at ways of funding startups and younger people to begin producing industrial goods or software or anything that can be sold outside of Australia that is not extracted from the land. And that is a difficult task, but without it, I think Australia is going to be falling behind in the next 20 years or so.
Yanis, you mentioned China in passing, and I'm neglectful in not raising China as a factor in the Australian economy, apart from the, you know, it's not simply the mining boom. How do our austerity measures relate to China's growth?
Directly. In the sense that, as we were saying before, Philip, if China were growing, China being a major trading partner of Australia and also a major trading partner of all the other trading partners of Australia, if China were growing at the rate that it was a few years ago, then possibly government expenditure cuts would not have the detrimental effects that they will end up having now. So Chinese growth is the key regarding the impact of this austerity budget. But it doesn't seem to me that China is going to be growing, and therefore I have no doubt that this budget is going to prove greatly irresponsible from a fiscal perspective.
And yet there's no great rational response from the federal opposition here. They seem to be floundering.
Social democratic parties, not just in Australia and in Britain, but in Europe as well, seem to have lobotomized themselves sometime in the late 1990s. Once they adopted the mantra of financialization and they started looking at finance as a source of funding for the welfare state that they still want to fund, once financialization went into reverse in 2008, I think they ran out of ideas. And I think that the Australian Labour Party, the British Labour Party, the social, great social democratic parties of Europe are now feeling the effects of this lobotomization.
It's a lovely phrase. I happened to eavesdrop on a conversation you were having with my producers in Sydney, and you were saying that you're hours away from finishing your latest book. Sneak preview in 60 seconds, please.
Yeah, well, it's called Europe Unhinged, and the subtitle will tell you the story, the next phase of the global crisis. I believe that Europe is perfectly capable of destabilizing the world one more time.
You're that apocalyptic.
I'm not apocalyptic. Our European leaders are. If you look at the comedy of errors which they've been orchestrating over the last 4 or 5 years, if you look at the fact that Italy, a great nation, is now insolvent and is being squeezed into the ground by a combination of austerity and a credit crunch, you'll realize that Europe is perfectly capable of becoming apocalyptic without my saying and uttering a single word.
Yanis, thank you very much for your time. Yanis Varoufakis, and you can read his splendid contribution to the latest edition of RN's White Paper. It's out now. You go to RN's front page, abc.net.au/RN, and there, lo and behold, is Yanis. Now, I hear some tweets approaching. And I understand this is the Diamond Dove.